This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another triple header with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with three interviews and three great guests. I'll call Tasmania to learn why it burned and why climate-driven fires threaten all of us. Our guest is world-recognized fire expert David Bowman. Then we'll investigate why the Obama administration is rushing to sell off oil and gas rights on the dangerous outer continental shelf of the Gulf of Mexico and in Alaska in the Arctic. Is that fire sale meant to fatten a Ponzi scheme of big oil stock prices? Economist John Talberth explains why he's suing the government. But first this. I'll bet you know who Paul Ehrlich is, but just in case, he's a professor of population studies at Stanford University and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Maybe you know him for the world-famous book co-authored with wife Anne, the classic The Population Bomb. Since then, Paul with Anne and other authors have published dozens of books. In February 2011, we interviewed Paul for his latest Humanity on a Tightrope, written with Robert Ornstein. Now Paul and Anne ask a rather extreme question, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, no less. Can a collapse of civilization be avoided? Dr. Paul Ehrlich, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here.
Paul, it's always an honor to talk with you, but I have to wonder, after a lifetime of weathering criticism, why did you put out this provocative paper? Why now?
Well, because, we just finished a presidential election in which no serious issue was ever debated. In the United States, we're seeing all this stuff about fiscal cliffs and debt limits and so on. All these things are trivia that are easily settled by negotiation among human beings. For example, nobody ever mentions that for every nickel of debt, there's somewhere a nickel of credit, that you could rearrange things that would involve some transfers of wealth. But nonetheless, people could solve that with paper and pencil, or at least with computers. What people don't seem to understand is you can't negotiate with nature. You can't say, well, we've raised the temperature by almost a degree Celsius, but we're going to break through 2 degrees. Nature, you've got to let us continue our agriculture even if we go up to 5 degrees. And the scientific community is worried sick. And, of course, we are faced with a dramatic program of disinformation funded, in this case, largely by the fossil fuel industry, which is trying to confuse people about how serious just one aspect of our environmental peril, that is climate disruption, is.
Well, I wonder, can a whole globalist civilization really go down? And what do you mean by collapse?
Well, collapse is there's a huge debate about exactly what constitutes a collapse. The classic Mayans had huge cities and temples and writing and scientists and so on, and now their descendants are basically small-time farmers, and they don't have anything we would consider civilization, like Western civilization. But basically, you can think of it as losing the things that people listening to this program value, that at the very most, people would be struggling most of the time just to get enough food and shelter to keep going. And that's the kind of collapse that globalization faces. After all, many, many civilizations have collapsed in the past. A few have recovered. The Egyptians are a good example, because their agriculture was, until we built the Aswan Dam, refreshed annually by the floods of the Nile. But most civilizations that have collapsed have not come back.
And you mentioned climate change, and we've talked about population, you've talked about population, but I counted 9 other developing ecological problems in your paper. Could you talk about a couple of those?
Sure. One of them is the spread of toxic chemicals from pole to pole, which people have been aware of, scientists have been aware of for some time, but they haven't been aware until recently of the importance of endocrine disrupting compounds, which are compounds like bisphenol A, you may have heard of, which have dramatic effects when they're in tiny quantities, and it can also poison you in large quantities, but the response is different whether you're exposed to a little bit or a lot. And we're seeing all kinds of nasty symptoms in animals traceable to these compounds, and there are frightening suggestions of things happening to the human population. For example, in some subarctic town, a lot of these chemicals tend to concentrate in the polar regions, and in some subarctic towns, they've recorded twice as many girl babies as boy babies, and that's a bad sign, because the normal ratio is about 105 boys to 100 girls. So when you're shifting the sex ratio like that, that's showing something in the environment is having a dramatic effect on development, and that's not the sort of thing you want to see. So toxic compounds, the global toxification, is particularly serious because if it really gets away from us, if it starts, say, giving everybody cancer of the pancreas by the time they're 10 years old, we won't have any clue what to do about it. There won't be any nutcase solutions like we have for climate change. So that's one problem. Another problem is the growing danger of vast epidemics. A huge problem written up in Michael Clare's new brilliant book, The Race for What's Left, is that we're going to more and more dangerous to get at and poorer resources, and we're likely to fight wars over them. We're already fighting wars over oil. We have fought a war. The Israelis and Syrians fought a war over water. And recent studies show that even a small nuclear war, say between India and Pakistan over agricultural water, would destroy our civilization. So there are a lot of problems out there, and some of the most basic ones, like the loss of biodiversity, the destruction of populations and species of the other organisms we're utterly dependent on, going on continuously and basically unnoticed. So it's not a pretty picture. The pretty part of the picture is if we really wanted to do something about it, we could.
Is population part of the, is it one of the vectors that you carry in your basket of threats to global civilization?
The two basic drivers are population growth and continued economic growth among the rich, overconsumption. Overpopulation and overconsumption are the two main drivers of the situation. And historically, since about 1880, population growth has accounted for somewhat more of the damage than increased consumption, but both of them are in there, and you can't really separate them. Trying to separate, say, which one is more responsible is like trying to say, is the length or the width of a rectangle more responsible for its area? So, yes, population is a major issue, and you may have noticed it's never discussed in the United States. In fact, there was a recent news release saying it was too bad that in California, the net reproductive rate, that is the family size, has dropped below 2. Well, that's extremely cheery news, but of course, idiot economists think it's bad. Yes, population, a central issue. As a matter of fact, the main criticisms we've had of our paper in the Journal of the Royal Society is it's too optimistic, particularly on the population front.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and Stanford biologist Paul R. Ehrlich. Paul, there is a disaster porn industry these days, but you published in a journal known for science. Is there science behind the possibility of civilization collapsing?
Oh, not only is there science behind it, we refer to about 160 articles, which is just a small sample. And, of course, the article was reviewed by dozens of people, including a Nobel laureate in economics and so on. In other words, this is not the view of a couple of eco-freaks. This is the standard view of the scientific part of the scientific community that looks at these things. The biggest argument I have with somebody on the topic, with a scientist on that paper, is with Jim Brown, who's a member of the National Academy and the world's most distinguished biogeographer. And I have told him that I think the chances of civilization surviving are about 10%, but that I'm willing to work hard to change it to 11% because I care a lot about my child and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And he says, Paul, you're crazy. I think the chances are only about 1%, but, of course, I'm willing to work to try and make it 1.1%. So while the Rush Limbaughs of the world don't even know what's happening, the scientific community is discussing how likely we are to be able to avoid the disaster that we're storming towards.
Well, yes, you told Stephen Lay of the Independent Press Service, we are all scared, and I don't see this fear in the TV shows or the mainstream media. So who is it that is scared?
Well, it's the scientific community, the environmental scientists, and particularly the climate scientists, because the most obvious change that we're watching now is the appearance of rapid climate change earlier than we expected. When we wrote the population bomb, Ralph Cicerone and others hadn't discovered the other parts of the heating forcing. That is, we just thought CO2 was the problem and not things like nitrous oxide and methane and so on. And now we're beginning to see the effects. So for instance, Australia is cooking right now with record temperatures, going to wreck their agriculture if they're not lucky, and so on right now. And this is just a small taste of what's going to come in the future. Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, just a small taste of what will become common in the future. The top climate scientist in the U.S. government, Jim Hansen, has actually gone to jail protesting coal plants. That's how seriously scared he is for his kids. The climate science community is desperately worried, but of course there is a well-paid prostitution ring, intellectual prostitutes paid by the fossil fuel industry to create confusion about it. If you don't believe it, there's a wonderful historian named Naomi Oreskes, who with a colleague wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt a couple of years ago, which goes into detail about how the Fox News Network and others are paid not to even mention climate disruption when we're now entering into a serious bout of it. Even today, the climate in the U.S. has changed dramatically. We have a cold spell in California and a warm spell in New York. The whole climate system is changing, and our food supply is utterly dependent on the climate system, to say nothing about our shorelines faced with inevitable sea level rise.
Well, in your paper for the Royal Society, you do offer some solutions, but just before we go there, Paul Ehrlich, do you have a sense of timing for this? If you had to set your future plans, like when to move out of town or something, when do you see a collapse being possible?
I think it could happen any time if we have either a resource war that turns nuclear or we're setting ourselves up for vast plagues. So that could happen any time. But in terms of more gradual things, I would say that it's becoming obvious to people in places like Australia right now, and I would say that in the next decade or so, it will become dramatically obvious to everyone, and the food situation, remember the food situation's already bad for a lot of people on the planet. Almost 1 billion people are hungry. There are food riots now because food prices are increasing. All that's likely to get worse. It's likely to get worse unevenly, but I think anybody who's really conscious of what's going on in the world can see it happening right now, and it's happening to a lot of people, but not people listening to this program.
Well, your paper suggests a couple of things that could be done to improve our food supply. Can you give us a snapshot of that?
Well, the first thing I would do is give women completely the same rights as men, opportunities, job opportunities, education, and every sexually active human being access to contraception, modern contraception, and backup abortion. Because if we don't move towards a gradual decline in the human population, there's no way we can support it because, of course, each person you add to the planet adds disproportionately to the chances of collapse in our environmental problems. So that's the first thing to handle because it's going to take a long time to move towards population shrinkage, whereas we can change our consumption patterns overnight. We should be working right now to get rid of fossil fuels. We shouldn't be fighting wars in Central Asia to get oil flowing towards our country. And about 40% of our military budget is designed solely to bring oil to the United States and our allies. And that's like if we were hungry, spending 40% of our military budget to bring cyanide to us to eat, because burning fossil fuels is a really bad idea, and we should be reducing it as rapidly as possible to half or less of what we burn now. So those are two places to start. And thinking about how we can share the wealth of the earth with the people who are living in misery, 3 or 4 billion people living in relative misery today, would be a good idea. In other words, instead of arguing about how many people we might possibly support in the future, why don't we learn to take good care of the people we have already?
Well, some of this leads to an inconvenient question. I interviewed Dr. Timothy Garrett from the University of Utah. 2 years ago, he published a scientific peer-reviewed paper showing only a complete collapse of our fossil-based civilization right now could avoid crushing climate change. And we're creating this deadly mass extinction event. Maybe we should help this suicidal system collapse instead of trying to save it. What do you think?
Well, I think just from a personal point of view and because of the friends and my children and grandchildren and so on, we ought to try and keep the lives of the people we have now in the best possible shape as long as we can, while we work very hard to see that in the near future the world has fewer people and living less heavily consumptive lives and paying much more attention to how they deal with, treat their environment and how they treat each other, because we don't do a very good job of treating each other either. So, but that's a personal ethical decision. You got to remember, when people say save the Earth, the planet isn't any danger at all. It'll be circling the sun for a very long time, I suspect, after Homo sapiens has disappeared. What we're caring about is the ability of the planet to give decent lives to people. And if we want a maximum number of people to live decent lives ever, we have to have a much smaller population for a long time, not jam as many people onto the planet over the next decade or so as we can and see the whole mess collapse.
What is foresight intelligence, and how could that help us?
Well, this is foresight is a form of intelligence that the MAHB, the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, MAHB.stanford.edu, is pushing. And the idea is, we have proven that simply telling people what the science says does not get the behavior changes that are necessary. That is, the situation with the climate has been worked out in great detail. 98% of climate scientists agree with it, and yet no action is being taken. You don't even hear it discussed. And so, what is the U.S. doing about climate change? The answer is, as a federal government, close to nothing. And that's something that has to be changed. And that means developing foresight intelligence. That is the intelligence in humanity, not just to look towards the future, but to change our behavior in response to what we see coming in the future. And we actually have an Institute for Foresight Intelligence here at Stanford now. But how to get it done? That's a question all of us have to be involved in.
You know, I told a friend I was going to talk with you about your new paper, and she was a bit impatient. She wanted to know, well, what's the answer? Can we save global civilization or not? What do you say?
Well, the answer is, yes, we can. But the big question is, will we? In other words, I'm very optimistic that if we went on to a crash basis like we did in 1941 after Pearl Harbor, that we could do the job. There will be difficulties and there will be premature deaths and so on, but we can save civilization, but only if we get into a crash program now. You can't wait another 10 or 20 years to see what happens and then suddenly try and revise our entire energy situation, reduce the size of our population, completely change our water handling infrastructure, which is something we have to do because the climate is, precipitation patterns are changing continuously over the next 1,000 years. All those things should be started right now, and we don't have the leadership or the knowledge to do it, and we've got to force that somehow. I'm sorry to be depressing, but I know you want the truth.
I do. That's why we called you up. And I wonder if there's something that I've missed or something else that you would really like to leave with our listeners.
Well, this isn't something you can depend on governments to take care of. I urge you to go to mahb.stanford.edu, even if you're just a concerned person, and get involved. Put your ideas in there. Everybody ought to be talking about how the hell do we get out of this miserable situation and give our kids and grandkids a decent life, and learn about it. You can get the paper online from the Royal Society Perspective section and read it and read the literature in it. Learn about it. None of the science is all that complicated. Many of the principles are extremely simple, so don't feel that you're helpless. Get involved. Get a movement going. Lean on your politicians. We all have to get together. We're social animals. We got to get together to solve the problem.
You've just heard Dr. Paul Ehrlich, co-author of The Population Bomb and much more. He's an esteemed professor of population studies and conservation biology at Stanford University. His latest paper, co-authored with wife Anne, is Can a Collapse of Global Civilization Be Avoided? Was published online January 13, 2013 in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. You can find that link in my blog at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Good luck to everybody and Happy New Year.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. The image of kids in the water clinging to a dock under a fire-red sky captured the situation. The Great Australian Heat Wave of 2013 also struck the southernmost part of the country, the island of Tasmania. Maybe this is the future anywhere trees grow, we wonder, as global warming heats the planet. Professor David Bauman is at the University of Tasmania in Hobart. He teaches and researches forest ecology. He's a published expert on fire in the Earth system. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, it's going pretty well here. It's wet here as opposed to what you're having. And I wanted to ask you, before we get to the science, is that kind of 40-degree heat and fire normal to Tasmania?
No. That day I was actually out in the wilderness, and I was telling my buddies that something absolutely catastrophic was happening. All of the switches were on for a fire catastrophe. And what was spooky for me, because I was uncontactable, is that I didn't learn about the fire disasters around Hobart until I got out 10 days later. We were safe, but the fact that the environment was tinder dry, the winds were very, very strong, the heat was excessive. So excessive, in fact, that around Hobart, some of the more sensitive plants have actually died off.
Just from the heat, not burning.
From the heat, not the drought.
My, my. So what is your impression of the public reaction? Are people worried by this? Has it raised the talk about possible climate change?
Yeah, well, there's two answers. I felt a moral dilemma because I knew this was going to happen. So a year ago, I wrote an article saying, I know a fire disaster will happen. I don't know when. I am certain that it's related to climate change, but I can't necessarily prove that. And that actually made me personally feel very good. And of course, it was passed unnoticed. A year later, it happened. Then the issue becomes politicized because the different political teams want to put different accents or emphases on this tragic event. And as a scientist, it's very important to give a tragic event a wide berth. It's not the time, to my way of thinking, you know, trying to argue the toss about whether it is or isn't, that particular event is or isn't climate change. But that's why I felt pleased that I was able to say it in a very neutral way a year ago when nobody was taking any notice. The awareness of fire in Australia has shot through the roof. And I think for thinking people, they're beginning to join the dots. They're looking at the landscapes that they're living in and realizing that some of the landscapes are way more vulnerable to a catastrophe than the fire that occurred, for instance, at Dunalley, where that extraordinary image of the family sheltering from a fire, it literally was a firestorm. It was something outside the bounds of normality for fire behavior. It hit fast and hard. It would have killed many people were it not for the fact that it was on a little peninsula, which has had a channel cut through it, and so everybody was able to take refuge into the water. Now, the weird thing about the Dunalley fire is that that's not a bushland setting. It's just a rural, it's got eucalypts and it's got bushland around it, but it's not the iconic bush settlement. It's not what you would think of as being highly vulnerable to a catastrophic bushfire. I've taken journalists who visited Tasmania to places that I say, you want to see where a catastrophic bushfire is going to occur. I take them to them and they get it very quickly, you know, dead end valleys, heavily settled, covered with eucalypts, you know, one spark and the whole damn thing's just going to kill everybody.
Well, and it's happened before in Australia. Back in 2009, 173 did die. But here's something that's puzzling me. Australia, I thought, just got some relief from that long-standing drought with a couple of wet seasons. How did such extreme fire conditions come up so quickly?
Yeah, well, that's actually interesting. A discovery that fire ecologists around the world have actually made is that, and again, I applied this logic and popularized it in the media, the discovery is that what's called antecedent rainfall, if you get two or three wet years, in the popular imagination, that's good for fire. But in a fire ecologist thinking, that's bad, because what you're doing is you're growing a superabundance of fuel. Really, it's the departure from those wet periods, what the climatic departure looks like. Is it abrupt and going into very dry, or does it sort of gradually tail off? Are there enough animals to eat all of the fuel? Are you able to use fire to reduce the fuel and so on? And what happened here is that we had this enormous quantity of growth after a very, very long drought. And then we got, as I said, a couple of these very hot days, which hayed off the grass and basically converted all of the fuel in the landscape, which was reasonably moist because there hadn't been a drought, to tinder. It's a terrible combination to have very wet periods, lush growth, followed by very extreme heat waves.
And are forest fires in Australia increasing generally, or is that just our impression due to media coverage?
A very good question, and a very difficult question to answer. The reason it's difficult to answer is because we don't have high-quality records. And in fact, this problem is a global problem. Now, in environments like tropical savanna environments, where fire occurs pretty well every other year or every year, using satellite imagery, you can build a very good appreciation of fire activity, and you can identify an anomalous year which has got a lot of fire activity or little. But in forest environments, which may take 30 to 100 years to regenerate and produce fuels for these high-intensity fires, maybe even 300 years, it's extremely difficult to go back 300 years because 300 years ago we didn't have satellites. And so we have to use historical reconstructions, and historical reconstructions are very fraught because they require quite intensive, complex technique. They're difficult to generalize. They've got lots of constraints. You know, they don't work in some settings. You might say, well, what about the colonial record? Well, of course, everything which was happening in the colonial period, colonists are learning as they're going along. When they came to Australia, they didn't go, well, this is a very fire-prone environment. We need to take detailed records of fire activity. They got shocked. Now, of course, the great irony is that there was another culture living in Australia for 40,000 years. And tragically, in southern Australia, we never tapped that cultural resource. We never learnt from the Aborigines. Well, you know, you imagine now if you could go back 200 or 300 years ago and talk to an Aboriginal landowner in Tasmania and say, well, tell me the story about how you guys manage fire. You know, what's this summer going to be like? They probably knew when the fire seasons were going to be good or bad. We just don't know what they were doing, how they were managing fire. It's quite tragic.
Well, have scientists estimated what will happen with global forests if we do go beyond the 2-degree safe point, or well beyond, perhaps?
The answer is a yes and no answer. Just using common sense logic, you know, fires increase when you get higher temperatures and dryness. And obviously, if you throw in the mix, more humans messing around with ignitions. And possibly, climate can increase the number of what are called dry lightning storms. The lightning storms that don't extinguish the starts. And there's concern that all of those things are happening. And they say, well, let's project into the future. Well, how will we project into the future? We'll have to use models. One of the real problems for the climate models is that they're really interested in the central tendency, as it's called, the averages, the sort of the mean values. What fire is about is the absolute outlying events. They're the game-changing things. It's, you know, imagine trying to predict in 100 years, the number of days where the fire danger is going to be catastrophic. I mean, you know, no scientist can do that. We can approximate and estimate and use lots of ingenious go-arounds, but we can't give a reliable indication. So we use common sense and we say global warming is going to result in more fire. But there's a very big catch and a very worrying catch. And the very big worrying catch is that if we get all of these fires, and we start emitting all of this stored solid carbon and turn it into gaseous carbon in the smoke, we may actually be putting an accelerant into the Earth system. That's a worry.
Right. That would be a positive feedback loop.
A positive feedback. And that's why we are worried. And once you see the general view of climate modelers is, well, fire just isn't such a big deal. It's a second or third order issue. Why would you be worrying yourself to death about building fire activity into an Earth system model? I can assure you that many clever modelers are now turning their minds to trying to represent fire in the Earth system in models. But as soon as they do that, they discover something quite horrible about fire. Fire is not like temperature. Fire is not like cyclones. Why? Because fire has three components. It has a geophysical component, which is like a cyclone, but it has a biological component. Fire is begot from life. The plants are the fuel, but the sorts of plants influence the fire behavior. if humans, say, mess around with vegetation, they can actually change the risk of fire. If they introduce flammable plants, they can, like eucalyptus, as they've done in California, they can increase the intensity and the severity of the fires. They can actually change ecosystems. But most critically, fire has a human dimension. We have forgotten something. We are fire animals. We're the only animal on Earth that uses fire routinely. We use it all the time. In fact, global climate change is because of our fire habit.
This is Radio EcoShock from Hobart, Tasmania. You are listening to forest ecologist David Bowman. Well, David, we've talked about getting that carbon released from the trees as they burn, but there's another aspect to this. There's new research out of the Journal of Geophysical Research about the role played by black carbon. They found black carbon, including from forest fires, is the second leading cause of global heating behind only carbon dioxide. What can you tell us about the black carbon impacts of wildfire smoke?
Yeah, really interesting effect that the wood smoke is a really interesting chemical cocktail and physical cocktail. It's not just like combusting the carbon, it also is putting black carbon. Black carbon is an incredibly efficient way of heating the atmosphere because it's black and it's soot. It's aerosols in the atmosphere, so it can heat up the atmosphere. Now, the critical reason why black carbon is so important is that it messes around with cloud formation. And there's great concern that you can actually aridify regions by injecting these plumes of black carbon into the atmosphere. And, of course, another feedback, that if you start drying out a region, then you start increasing the likelihood of fire. And before you know it, you're getting a nice, steady source of this black carbon, which is actually changing the regional climate, and which would then change the fire activity, which would then change the vegetation, which would then change the world.
And if some of those forests convert into grasslands finally, they just burn too many times, then again we've lost something that was formerly sucking up the atmosphere and creating rain clouds.
Correct. The concern, the vulnerability of the Amazon or tropical rainforest, which are now increasingly recognised as extremely efficient at recycling moisture. So not only are they carbon stores, but they're also water pumps. And the vulnerability of drought and fire to these systems, and you can imagine what many ecologists are beginning to see as these not gradual declines, but actually switches, abrupt catastrophic switches of state from, say, and you know, there are good examples in the northern part of the US and in Canada, we've got pine forests which are getting burnt so intensively that they don't regenerate after the fire, and you switch from a forest to a prairie. So you can actually have these catastrophic switches. And as soon as you do that, it's very difficult to ever come back to the forest. You can get back to the forest, but it's difficult. It's got a bigger hole to climb out of.
And we've got problems here in North America, right along the Rockies, with beetles that are boring into the trees and killing them. So now we've got whole vast valleys of dead trees, and the American West is drying right out. All of that is affecting these trees. Are there similar things going on in the Southern Hemisphere, or less so?
Very, very good question. Less so. The most drought-affected part of the Australian forests are in southwest Western Australia, where the trees are literally collapsing from drought stress. Now, in those situations, there's great concern that you're elevating the fuel load, and because you've got all of this extra fuel, you can imagine you could be going towards some sort of vegetation shift. But around Tasmania at the moment, the droughts haven't been severe enough. But if what's happening in southwestern Western Australia is sort of like the leading edge, if you get strong enough drought, we can imagine that we could be looking at some state shifts. There is another example of a state shift which is a little bit related, but related to the effect of fire, and that's where you get double or triple fires in very short succession before the trees can mature. And we're worrying that there are areas in the Australian Alps which may have been converted from forest to some sort of degraded forest. I'm not saying all of the trees have been eliminated, but certainly a vast quantity of the trees have been eliminated from these double fires, because the trees were killed, they set seeds which regenerated, which were then killed very quickly. in other fires, which happened maybe 4 or 5 years later, which is an extraordinarily high frequency. You know, we would, you know, normally in nature, you would expect the next fire to be 40 or 50 years later.
So if we get more fires faster, that matters.
Hugely, hugely. It's like, yeah, it's like, you know, a classic sort of demographic catastrophe where you're just never letting anything mature. So you will get things that can mature, but they got to mature quickly. So you may be driving it into some sort of uber fireweeds, you know, these sort of super plants, which just get a mature fast, you know, ready to burn again.
We're talking with forest ecologist David Bowman from Tasmania. David, there have been some international efforts towards agreements to protect rainforests, for example, from intentional burning, and there's been talk about changing the burning of agricultural waste. Are these talks pointless? Are we getting anywhere? What would you suggest?
Well, I think that the horrifying interactions which I've been talking about and their capacity to accelerate change probably has been overlooked. So we are making progress, yes, but the threats and the compounding effect of the threats has probably been underestimated by policymakers. It's not to criticise the climate modellers, but, you know, we have a very sort of thermostat view of climate change, and, you know, we're 2 degrees, 1 degree, 4 degrees, you know, but no, we're talking with fire, we're talking about the tails of the distribution, the extremes. And the terrifying thing is that those extreme events start messing with the thermostat. In other words, the worst case scenario is we could lose control of many of the things we thought we had control of. We don't have as many options as we think we have. That's the worst case scenario.
Frankly, from the scientists I've talked to, I think we're at that point, or we're very quickly approaching it. What are you looking into these days? What research needs to be done?
Well, I'm doing two things. Being in Australia, we have an extraordinary opportunity to understand fire. It's probably one of the most amazing fire laboratories on Earth. We are doing, in collaboration with an American colleague funded by NASA, we're looking at the effect of these big fires all over the continent and looking at fuel, the fuel types and the amount of fuel that's burnt in these big fires. And that's a comparative study because that will be comparing the same methodology to the Western US and into Brazil. So there are global comparisons which are critical. Another project which I'm collaborating with another US team and New Zealand and to a degree South American is that we're looking at reconstructing fire activity in the Southern Hemisphere and understanding whether there's some sort of modality that when New Zealand burns or when Tasmania burns, is that the time when Chile doesn't burn? You know, what are the big scale climate drivers that maybe have put some sort of tempo into Southern Hemisphere fire activity? The Southern Hemisphere isn't well known, and these flammable landscapes have sort of been overlooked, but they're extremely interesting, particularly Australia because of eucalyptus. So, of course, I'm studying eucalyptus, trying to understand its ecology, and I'm trying to understand whether eucalyptus has done something evolutionarily different and become maybe the plant equivalent of us, because we're the fire animal and maybe eucalyptus is the fire tree. And if it is the fire tree, future generations may be wondering why the hell did these guys spread it all over the world, because it's going to take with it fire. And we are hearing reports of concern about eucalyptus, say, in the Mediterranean. It's in a league of its own in terms of plants that like to catch on fire and spread sparks and hoard flammable fuels and all the rest of it. So, yeah, they're the sorts of things. I've obviously been working with Aboriginal people and trying to understand Aboriginal fire use. That's something which has preoccupied an enormous amount of my life because I got annoyed at people theorising about prehistory and we still had Indigenous people burning country. So I went into Arnhem Land in Northern Australia and over 15 years have worked with one family group and watched and worked with them, studied with them, how they burnt land and how they felt about fire. And it's a very different way to think about fire than we have. They're very comfortable with fire. Fire's like their pet. It's their friend. It's just their thing. Kids play with fire.
This is fascinating stuff. From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been chatting with Dr. David Bowman. He's a professor of forest ecology at the School of Plant Science at the University of Tasmania. I'll put a link to his profile in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, and you can follow up from there. David, it's been so good talking to you across this great Pacific Ocean that we share.
No worries. It's been good talking to you, and enjoy your winter.
Okay. Bye-bye. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith with the case you probably haven't heard about. The U.S. federal government seems permanently on the edge of bankruptcy, as you know, and the public always wants lower gas prices at the pump. So now the Obama administration is auctioning off huge tracts of the Outer Continental Shelf to big oil and gas companies. Our guest economist John Talberth says that's a bad idea on so many levels. His group, the Center for Sustainable Economy, has taken the government to court to stop it. John Talberth, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be on the show.
Well, surely the U.S. should be aiming for energy independence. Why is your group trying to block these new ocean oil rights with a lawsuit?
Well, first of all, the path to energy independence is not to take us down the path of more dependence on fossil fuels. I mean, A, it's not sustainable. B, it comes at enormous cost. And C, the resources that we're actually developing on the Outer Continental Shelf and elsewhere are not really being designed for consumption in the U.S. There's, in fact, a large portion of these programs that are being developed for the export market. So there's no real correlation between energy independence and the new fossil fuel programs that the Obama administration is pursuing, including developing the Outer Continental Shelf, which, of course, is the subject of our litigation.
Well, what is the official name for this program?
Well, every 5 years, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management develops what is known as the Outer Continental Shelf Oil and Gas Leasing Program. That's the official name of the program. It was authorized by Secretary Salazar in late August, and we filed our lawsuit, at least the initial pleadings in our lawsuit, in early December.
Well, before we talk, John, more about that lawsuit, I think we need to deconstruct a little of what you said in the beginning, because there are fundamental issues at stake here. First of all, just as a business decision, why would they organize to sell off natural gas rights when gas prices are so low that existing leases haven't even been developed yet?
It's not just gas, it's oil. We're at a time when there's a record backlog of leases, not only of natural gas in the West and the Northeast, but of unused oil leases offshore. It makes one wonder, given just how sensitive these resources are, and given that we really need to be stretching out our oil and gas supplies as long as we possibly can, why the administration is rushing headlong into a new program to develop these leases offshore. So the only economics that makes sense is when you consider what these new oil and gas leases do for oil and gas companies' bottom line, their balance sheets. And what these companies get to do is put these new leases on their asset sheets as assets that they eventually have the rights to develop, and thereby keep their share prices high and keep interest in their companies high enough to keep going economically. So it's really just about helping oil and gas companies meet shareholder expectations and not so much about meeting America's energy needs.
Well, that sounds like a kind of subsidy, and I like the idea that your lawsuit raises the point that our children and grandchildren might have a right to national resources as well. That seems so obvious. Did the government consider that?
Not at all. One of the key contentions in our lawsuit is that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the Obama administration, did not consider at all in any way, shape, or form the vast economic benefits that could be realized if we defer new leasing decisions until we really demonstrate that there's a need for this oil and gas. And so, you know, under the National Environmental Policy Act, this is kind of known as the no-action alternative, and it's supposed to be treated in a fair and balanced way in comparison with the action alternatives in the cost-benefit analysis. And instead of treating the no-action alternative in a fair and balanced and unbiased way, the administration simply chose not to look at the economic benefits of waiting or not developing the resource at all.
Well, that's a major point. And then we have the huge costs of damages if another big oil platform burns or leaks offshore, like the Deepwater Horizon did. Did they look at that?
They purport to have, but as you know, the technology associated with deep water drilling, and just in the latest round of leases offered for sale, there's at least 32 individual lease sales that have been executed that are in waters even deeper than Deepwater Horizon. And we're at a point where the technology associated with keeping those wells safe is not nearly as far along as the industry makes it out to be and as the administration thinks it is in the context of its programmatic documents it used, it relied on to authorize its new program. So the technology really isn't there. It's questionable. We're seeing evidence of that all the time. We just saw another drilling rig disaster in Alaska. We saw another drilling rig disaster just a few months after Deepwater Horizon, and another one last summer. So clearly, we're putting our shores at risk for energy supplies we don't really need. And this is kind of the crux of the lawsuit, that when you look at the economics of the risk versus the benefit, it just doesn't add up.
Right. I did a little investigation into this. I had a look at the maps for the leasing areas, and some of them are in the fragile Arctic where there are no spare rigs to move over and cap a blown-out well or anything like that. And the maps show lease sales areas like huge in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea, right on the very northernmost coast of Alaska. Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. And then offshore in the Gulf of Mexico as well. And the irony is that we're, you know, should those leases be developed, there's a very high likelihood, at least in today's market, that the refined oil products and even the gas, increasingly, that will come from these wells will then just be shipped overseas. So Americans get all the risk and all the costs, but we wouldn't even get the benefit of consuming these energy supplies under this existing program. It's another consideration that the Obama administration completely overlooked in its economic analysis.
And there were some interesting little details on the maps. All the proposed lease areas in the Arctic appear to be within a line identifying, quote, polar bear critical habitat seaward extent, and also within an area marked subsistence high use, which I presume must mean space used by the Inuit people for their subsistence hunting. So the government knows both wildlife and Aboriginal people in the north are going to be impacted. Did the Environmental Protection Agency leap in there and do an analysis of that risk?
Just in a very cursory manner, but our lawsuit focuses on the benefit-cost analysis. And what we have demonstrated over and over again in other situations in the Arctic and elsewhere in the U.S. is that when these big infrastructure projects or big energy projects are put in sensitive subsistence areas, the government has an obligation to do it the best job it can to quantify the economic costs and benefits associated with developing the new project and developing new oil and gas leases on subsistence uses. They didn't do that. They didn't assign any kind of values to those subsistence uses or factor in the cost to subsistence users. And that's, again, another way in which the benefit-cost analysis is biased in this case in favor of new drilling as opposed to deferring or excluding areas that are highly sensitive.
Funny how it always works that way. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. John Talberth, an economist who heads up the Center for Sustainable Economy, and that's based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're talking about new oil and gas leases being given out to major fossil fuel companies in sensitive and dangerous parts of the outer continental shelf. Well, John, when we think of climate damage, too, just consider the $60 billion relief package proposed for Hurricane Sandy. There's a lot more of those coming in the future if we keep pumping out this oil and gas. Did the EPA calculate the real cost of grabbing more carbon from the deep ocean shelves?
You know, that cost is, as we all know, is astonishing, and it just should be the governing factor in whether or not new fossil infrastructure is developed. What is this going to do to the Earth's climate? We already just saw today the announcement that 2012, at least in the U.S., was the hottest year on record. Every time we look at the temperature trends, it seems like we're on the worst-case scenario. And with that as the backdrop, it's utterly irresponsible for the Obama administration to be pushing new fossil fuel infrastructure development to the extent it is. And part of the reason they're doing that over and over again is based on faulty economic analysis that don't put a price tag on the cost that each metric ton of new carbon that is burned and goes into the atmosphere is creating on the economy downstream. So, you know, it's just another example of how biased and distorted the economic analyses on which they're relying to authorize these new projects.
Well, you know, we can't put a cost-benefit analysis on the fact that this kind of action drives some of my listeners nuts to see how insane it is to drill more oil and gas in the Arctic, just as we're getting all the news about the sea ice melting back and Greenland glaciers really are melting back. Doesn't anyone in the government see how crazy this is?
There are plenty of people in the government who see how crazy it is and talk to us behind closed doors. But when they actually make decisions, lo and behold, those people are kept in the shadows. And this is one of the tragic realities of energy policy in this country, is that notwithstanding all the positive talk President Obama engages in terms of, you know, we need an energy future based on renewables, and all the governors setting coming out together saying we've got to make the transition, and the public being loud and clear about it. When it comes to actual decision making, where we're actually putting federal dollars, state dollars, local dollars, you can follow the trail of that money right back to the new gas wells and the new oil rigs and the new coal mines. It's just, you know, one of the tragic aspects of energy policy in this country is that all the talk about renewables and making the transition and conservation and efficiency is all talk and bluster, while the actual decisions on the ground are to keep on developing new fossil resources.
Well, I think we're just addicted. So, John Talberth, please give us the details of the lawsuit against this resource sell-off. Who's backing the suit? Where is it filed? And all that stuff.
Sure. Well, the Center for Sustainable Economy is the sole plaintiff. However, we are backed in the lawsuit in terms of providing legal support by the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York University School of Law. Center for Sustainable Economy has filed this suit on behalf of our partners and members who reside in the Gulf region, reside in the Alaska region, who are deeply concerned about America's energy policy and the risk of another blowout like Deepwater Horizon, and really want to see us taking the transition to renewables seriously. Now, there's three key issues in the lawsuit and three statutes under which we're litigating. Those statutes are the National Environmental Policy Act, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and the Administrative Procedures Act. In terms of the issues, there's three. First, we believe the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management relied on a deeply flawed economic analysis, as I just discussed, to approve the program. The analysis fails to either meet professional standards or those set by law. As one example, despite the legal requirements to only consider benefits to the American public of new energy resources that are developed, BOM actually considered oil and gas industry profits, including foreign firms and benefits to foreign consumers from export of the refined product. So that's kind of the first bullet, is the flawed economic analysis. The second issue is that the programmatic environmental impact statement that they developed under NEPA supporting the program is extremely biased in favor of new drilling relative to the no-action alternative that would leave oil and gas reserves in the ground for future generations' benefit. And the third issue is that the BOM failed to incorporate the option value of waiting to develop additional oil and gas reserves in the future rather than now, and to demonstrate that we actually need these oil and gas reserves in today's market. So these are the issues and the statutes we're litigating under.
And what court is it being filed in?
It was filed in the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, which is established by law as where one has to file in challenging the Outer Continental Shelf oil and gas program.
The House Budget Committee requested a report from the Congressional Budget Office on how much money could be expected from these leases. And in the Arctic, it's only a few billion dollars, and some of that goes to the state of Alaska, all that risk for so little. But who is the chair of the House Budget Committee? It's former vice presidential candidate, Tea Party backer, and deep friend to the oil companies, Paul Ryan. It's the same Ryan who wants to keep $40 billion in oil company subsidies. Paul Ryan got over $100,000 in campaign contributions from Koch Industries. He speaks to and for the Koch brothers at various events. He questions or denies the science behind global warming. You know, so congressional leader Paul Ryan pushes this sweetheart deal for the oil companies to get their hands on resources owned by the public. Do you think I'm wrong in assessing it that way?
Well, you know, there's only a few explanations, and that's certainly one of them. And again, getting back to the argument of why are we moving ahead with new leases, why the oil and gas companies are just sitting on a huge backlog of them, it gets down, to their balance sheets and the fact that they get to count these as assets, private assets that help prop up their shareholder value. So the entire benefit really is for the oil and gas companies. There's nothing to do with energy security and America's energy independence. You know, it's as good a guess as any.
Well, I understand that one auction for the offshore leases already went ahead in November 2012. Can your lawsuit stop the continuing sales of these public resources?
Well, if the court agrees with us, yes, it certainly will. We're seeking to remand the program back to BOEM to do an adequate job in its economic analysis and seriously evaluate whether new leasing is actually required at this time. If the court agrees with us, it would bring a halt to development of these new leases.
Well, now, I understand that Bolivia and Ecuador suggested they would leave some oil and gas in the ground rather than damage the climate further. They worried about future generations. But we're still not hearing anything like this from the U.S. government, are we, or are we?
We're not hearing anything at all. As usual, in the realm of energy and climate, the U.S. is playing catch-up. You know, now that the election is over with, perhaps the Obama administration can step up to the plate and demonstrate some leadership rather than lagging behind, as we've historically done.
Well, John Talberth, you're an economist, the doctorate and all for the Center for Sustainable Economy. The bottom line, is fossil fuel, is that economy sustainable?
Absolutely not. By definition, it's not sustainable because there's only a limited amount of reserves, and there's even more limited amount of reserves that are economically feasible to develop. We may have already hit that mark. In fact, the scientists tell us, just from a purely from a climate change economic standpoint, that we need to be looking at leaving at this point 60 to 80% of the proven reserves in the ground as the only way that we're actually going to be able to meet the objective of holding the global temperature rise down to 2 degrees centigrade by 2050. So we may have already reached the point where developing new fossil fuel resources is impractical for economic reasons and for climate reasons. And it is our intent in this lawsuit to get the government to seriously consider the benefits of deferring or not developing the resource at all. If it does need to be developed, then perhaps it needs to be developed at a time where we really need it, when we're not exporting oil and gas at record levels.
Well, I think you may have hit it with your suit by saying the benefit goes to the shareholders, because in a way this oil development industry, the exploration that goes on and on at tremendous cost, it seems to me like it's sort of a Ponzi scheme, that if you ever get to that point where you say, well, we can't afford to develop anymore, so just stop the exploration, that oil industry might collapse.
Well, they're going to be forced to make a transition, that's for sure, but that's the transition that needs to happen. I mean, we have to stop postponing the day of reckoning where oil and gas companies get into a new line of work. But this is what they have to do.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add? And also, is there a website where people can keep track of what's happening with this case and these leases?
Yeah, absolutely. The Center for Sustainable Economy website at www.sustainable-, the dash is very important, economy.org. All the updates and the postings and the lawsuits and the filings and the lawsuits are available there, and we will keep you up to date. And just in closing, you know, I just have to say that in the run-up to the election, it was apparent that both the president and Mitt Romney were trying to outdo each other with who could build the biggest pipeline and drill the most holes. And it was really a low point in the history of this nation's debate over energy policy, and we're hoping at least that this lawsuit can now change the terms of the debate to get back to public interest economics. What is really grounded in good economics that is of benefit to the American people and is not just a chit to be used in the election cycle?
This is Radio EcoShock, and we've been digging into more skullduggery as public wealth slides cheap into private hands, endangering the future of all. Our guest is Dr. John Talberth, President and Senior Economist for the Center for Sustainable Economy. John, thank you so much for taking this stand.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be on the show.
I'm Alex Smith. Find links for this interview, including maps of the ocean rights being sold off, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Find all the links from this program at ecoshock.info. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock as we report from around the world. Thank you for listening. Some show music was provided by Vast Mandana at soundclick.com. We'll go out with a bit of a new song from Kukulkan, Mother Nature, Mother Earth.
Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, mankind ain't been so kind to you. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you crying. Deforestation, industrialization has taken a toll on you. Ice caps are melting, changing ocean currents, and the weather in the